talked about the three portals, and today I wanted to talk a little bit more concretely about phenomenology of dark matter going through the vector portal. So this will hopefully combine some of the stuff that I've been talking about and that Matt was just talking about with what Mariangela covered earlier. I think we should always think broadly about what dark matter could be. We really don't know what it is or what it isn't until we find it. But one thing that weighs in my mind when I think about, how seriously should I look for new ideas for dark matter? As I ask, well, what are the simplest ideas and how well have we tested them? And so to me, this picture that I talked about yesterday, that you can have that any time the cross-section for annihilation of dark matter is around 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second. So that's the thermal average cross-section times velocity, that you get a good, that annihilation process and its time reverse process can in the early universe provide a good explanation for where the dark matter came from. And I mentioned that picture sets an upper bound on the dark matter mass, but not a lower bound. That for strong couplings, that mass would have to be around the sort of 10 to 100 GeV range. But for arbitrarily weak couplings, the mass could get much smaller. And this morning, we saw one natural way that very weak couplings could come about is precisely through these portal interactions with another sector. So I think that is in its own right a reasonable part of dark matter parameter space to think about. But there is an even more compelling part of dark matter parameter space, which is the WIMP part of parameter space, where the mass is around, say, MW to TeV, and the coupling that you need to get the right annihilation cross-section is sort of close to an electroweak coupling. So those are not just two scales that are consistent with this annihilation cross-section, but two scales that are already singled out as interesting from the perspective of electroweak physics, a scale and a coupling that are already singled out as interesting, and that lie roughly on this line. So to me, if I'm going to think about other kinds of thermal relic dark matter, one question I should ask is, well, how do they stack up compared to the sort of canonical WIMP dark matter? It's a model against which you should measure things and against which we should measure the progress of experiments. So if I had my slides, you'd be able to see a beautiful picture of a mass of the dark matter versus scattering cross-section for dark matter off a nucleon, where all of the curves look something like this. And I think Mariangela explained where this shape comes from, that at high masses, there's a lower density of dark matter. At low masses, your detectors typically have a threshold. And so every experiment looks a little bit different, but they've been sort of marching down this way with sensitivity from a few GeV. And then the flat bottom starting to taper off around the scale of nuclear masses of 100. GeV or so. And these cross-section sensitivities have gotten down to about 10⁻⁷ centimeters squared. So one question we can ask is, how does this stack up compared to what we might expect for weakly interacting dark matter? I think I'm actually going to do without, well, no, you know what? I'll keep the screen. I'll want it sooner or later.
Why don't you put it by the screen?
Huh?
Don't be putting by the screen. We can take it out. I can take it out.
I'll want it soon. I'll want it later. Right. So I'll keep it. It'll force me to Hopefully it won't force me to write small, because that'll backfire. It will keep... it'll keep half of you in the dark about what's on my x-axis. But... but the half of you that chose to sit on the left axis, on the left side of the room, will know that it's the mass of the dark matter. So how does this stack up? Okay, I'll use this part of the board after all. So one thing you might have expected for weakly interacting dark matter, say it's in some weak, you know, some SU2 multiplet, that you could have interactions mediated by the Z. So you'd have some nucleon coupling, and then the dark matter coupling to the Z. And we know what that cross-section should scale like. It should go, so it's going to have an mz to the fourth in the denominator, alpha 2 squared, and then there's a reduced mass of, say, the proton and the dark matter squared in the numerator. For most of this region where direct detection has something interesting to say, that reduced mass is just the mass of the proton. So we can just straight estimate this. And we get 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared as the scale of that cross-section, with the exact numerical factor depending on whether the dark matter is in a doublet or a triplet or larger representation of SU2. So that's somewhere way up here. And that's actually what this series of direct detection experiments was originally motivated by in the early days of this experimental program. Now, we haven't seen it, and we still talk about WIMP dark matter. So one reason we haven't seen it is that not all electroweak multiplets have Z interactions. A real multiplet, well, for example, you know there's no 3Z interaction in the standard model. I mean, there is, but it's a loop level process. If the dark matter is in any kind of real representation, then you don't necessarily get this kind of process. The other thing, even if dark matter was, say, in a doublet, you can have symmetry breaking effects that split the neutral part of the doublet. So you say dark matter is a vector-like SU2 doublet. In other words, there's a doublet of charge. Doublet of charge 1/2 and a doublet of charge minus 1/2. They combine together with a Dirac mass. That's what makes the dark matter. And so your singlet part, your neutral part, which is actually going to be the dark matter, would just have some m psi bar psi, if it's a fermion, type of mass. But you can also add to that small subleading corrections that actually split psi into, so I believe I can think of these as an axial piece, that would actually split psi into a pair of Majorana multiplets of Majorana fermions that have different masses. And then the Z coupling is always off diagonal from the lighter state to the heavier state. And so, or from the heavy state to the lighter state. But if the heavy state's depopulated, you just have a bunch of the light state around, and it's, you know, plodding along in the galaxy at its measly speed of a couple hundred kilometers a second, then you don't necessarily have enough kinetic energy to excite to the higher state. And so this could be pretty easily rendered invisible in these direct detection experiments. Now, what else would you then expect to see? Well, maybe there's some coupling to the Higgs. So you could also think about processes like this. Now, I don't know what the dark matter Higgs coupling is. If any of you do, please tell me. Call it Y dark matter. We do know roughly that the Higgs nucleon coupling should go like some QQ bar matrix element between neutron states. And that, for a fermion mass operator, so you're just evaluating the matrix element of the mass operator. And that winds up being around I think 60 MeV, or around 10 to the minus 4. This expectation, mass expectation, is around 60 MeV. This is just the statement that most of the neutrons' mass isn't coming from quark masses from electroweak symmetry breaking. It's coming from the gluons. That corresponds to a coupling, a Yukawa coupling to the Higgs around 10 to the minus 4. And so because this coupling is so small, the scattering cross-section is going to be smaller. So the cross-section for Higgs-mediated would be something like 10 to the minus 44 centimeters squared times that unknown dark matter Yukawa coupling squared. Now, maybe the dark matter Yukawa coupling is large. After all, it's a heavy particle. Much of its mass could come from some other mechanism, but some of its mass could come from the Higgs mechanism as well. You want it to have a reasonably large Yukawa coupling if it's going to annihilate through this process. So there's reason to think that this within a couple orders of magnitude is a reasonable scale to associate with Higgs-mediated scattering. But strictly speaking, you could always dial that down. So that puts you, that's a process that the sort of latest generation of direct detection experiments is really squarely starting to probe. And that the next generation will, I think, probe pretty well. But this is also something that you can, if you really want to, dial away. What's really absolutely necessary, if you ever absolutely forced on you, if you want to have dark matter in an electroweak multiplet, is that there will be some diagonal or off-diagonal interactions with both the Z and the W. But if these are mass off-diagonal, then they only appear in direct detection at loop level. And that gives you cross-section something more like 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared, which we haven't gotten to yet. Now, so this is still something that will be accessible above the neutrino background to start probing scattering cross-sections of this scale. But having said that, so I do feel like direct detection is well on its way to probing this sort of basic WIMP scenario pretty well. Having said that, I do wish, this is where I wish I had the projector. Okay, actually, can I move this screen in front? Yeah. That way it doesn't take up all my other blackboards. No, no. This is perfect. So having said that, I don't want to act like we'll ever truly be done testing WIMPs with this direct detection alone, because there's a very nasty fact that these two can interfere destructively with each other. And in fact, if you consider doublet dark matter, okay, so just a weak SU2 doublet, but the kind I was describing where you have a 2 with charge 1/2, a doublet with charge minus 1/2, they marry together into a Dirac fermion, and then some other subleading effect splits the neutral state into its real and imaginary part so that Z goes away. That's a pretty simple scenario for dark matter, okay? But it does possess this destructive interference. As a function of Higgs mass, you can therefore calculate the sum of of those amplitudes squared and for a cross-section. Okay, and so here it is. At low Higgs masses, it's sort of reasonable. 10 to the minus 48. And then at high Higgs masses, it's also kind of reasonable, maybe eventually accessible, 10 to the minus 49. But there's a destructive interference, so there's going to be some value of the Higgs mass where it goes through zero. And this blue band is the uncertainty in where that value of the Higgs mass happens to be. And I hope you guys remember that it was crossing zero right around 126. So there are simple models of weak multiplet dark matter, in particular just doublet dark matter, that are basically invisible to direct detection. Okay, so this will never be a complete closure of the WIMP dark matter possibility by itself. But I do think direct detection puts enough strain on WIMPs that even if we didn't want to think about other dark matter models before, we should probably be open-minded and think about other dark matter models now. Okay, so maybe one of the first questions that would lead you to ask is, all right, easiest candidate seems to just be go below these thresholds. Why don't we think about WIMP dark matter models below a few GeV in mass? Okay, so that dark matter could annihilate, say, through the Z. Now, in all of those diagrams, time was going up. Now I'm going to draw the exact same diagram with time going this way. I could have my dark matter annihilating through Z into some standard model fermions. And now the cross-section for this, I should be more careful because I have two very different mass scales now, the chi mass scale and the Z mass scale. So when I talk about how my cross-section scales with mass, I need to keep track of both of them. And what you find is that the annihilation cross-section, well, it's obviously going to have an mz squared in the amplitude. When I square that, I get an mz to the fourth in the cross-section. The dimensions are made up by an m chi squared in the numerator, and then I'm going to have a weak coupling to the fourth. So this here, this is just a G Fermi squared. And you see that as I lower the chi mass, well, this combination isn't changing, I'm just going to get smaller and smaller cross sections. And so it is completely impossible. This combined with the requirement that sigma v should go like 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second. And sorry, really, this isn't just the annihilation cross section, this is sigma v for these models. Implies a lower bound on m chi, that m chi should be greater than a few GeV. And that's what's called the Lee-Weinberg bound. So that's the reason why we don't talk about WIMPs with lower masses than this. Where by WIMPs, I mean dark matter with a standard annihilating through a standard model weak interaction. But since we've already been talking about the possibility of new sectors with lower mass scales, weaker couplings to the standard model, it's natural to ask the question, how could those play a role in dark matter? And there's basically two scenarios that we can consider. So I'm gonna start from, sorry, eraser. So why don't I just define my model? I'll consider, well, I'm not gonna be that strict. I'm gonna change back and forth between fermion and scalar dark matter, and for many purposes it won't matter. So I'm going to imagine dark matter to be either a fermion psi or scalar phi charged under some U1 dark mediated by an A prime. And this one will have mass an A prime, and these could have mass. Actually, I'll go ahead and call this chi like I did in the last lecture, mass m chi, or m phi. So depending on the hierarchy of masses, I could have two different processes that are important. If the A prime mass is larger than the chi mass, then the only thing I can do through that interaction, I'll never be able to produce an A prime on shell through non-relativistic chi-chi bar annihilation. but I can have a process mediated by an off-shell A prime that goes to standard model fermions. So this is my dark sector coupling, G dark, whatever gauge coupling chi happened to have to the A prime, independent of kinetic mixing. This is the vertex that I get from kinetic mixing, and it's going to go like epsilon E times the charge of that fermion. So the annihilation cross-section for this is going to go something like alpha dark, so that's just defined in the usual way, g dark squared over 4 pi, epsilon squared alpha over the mass of the mediator to the fourth. Technically, I'm really going to have some more careful propagator here, but we can typically work in a case where these are either of the same order of magnitude without a fine cancellation, or this is much larger. So I'll often just estimate this as an A prime to the fourth in the denominator, and an M chi squared making up dimension. So exactly the same form as in that Lee-Weinberg case, except now my equivalent combination to G Fermi is this one. Now, we shouldn't make the A prime mediated force among standard model fermions stronger than G Fermi, because that would obviously be, you know, have lots of consequences. That means that we shouldn't be considering epsilon squared alpha over MA prime squared, that this should be less than G Fermi. But alpha dark can be much larger than epsilon squared alpha. So this combination here could be much greater than G Fermi squared, giving you a viable annihilation for anything from chi masses of MeV up to multi-GeV. So that's one case. The second case we can consider is if the mass of the A prime was less than M chi. And then there's another process that doesn't even have any epsilon suppression at all, which is chi chi bar annihilation into two A primes. And then they're heavy, they can't decay into chi. They're light. They're lighter than the chi, so they certainly can't decay into a pair of chi's. But they could decay, each one of them, to FF bar. And this would give you a cross-section of order m chi squared alpha dark squared. Sorry. Just alpha dark squared over m chi squared. The characteristic scale here. So for reasonable alpha dark and small m chi's that I was talking about, this is typically kind of large. This is a bit large for m chi of order a GeV. But fine for weak scale chi. So that's a perfectly reasonable possibility for how dark matter could annihilate into a lighter dark gauge boson. And this is often referred to as secluded dark matter. But I mainly want to talk today about the lighter dark matter possibility. So I already said, one other point I'll make about this. Why is it called secluded dark matter? It's called secluded dark matter because the annihilation process doesn't care at all about epsilon. You can imagine taking epsilon extremely small, and then all the scattering rates, say for direct detection, are going to go something like, so here I have some nucleon, here I have my chi. Those scattering rates are going to go something like, they'll have their MA prime to the fourth in the denominator, mu chi nucleon squared And then we have this alpha dark epsilon squared factor. As epsilon gets tiny, the direct detection cross-section gets tiny. Up here, when we're thinking about very low masses, the direct detection cross-section isn't that tiny. It's related by crossing to the process that we're interested in for annihilation, which is substantial. But if you're living to the left of that, on the left-hand side of that plot, then direct detection isn't very sensitive anyway. So both of these classes of models, sort of GeV scale dark matter or the secluded model even for larger dark matter, are largely invisible to direct detection. So, okay, we know, I mean, Mariangela talked about another way of looking for dark matter too, which is indirect detection. And at some very crude level, indirect detection is sensitive to the total power injected into the universe, into different aspects of the universe by dark matter annihilation. So that's sensitive to the number density of dark matter squared. That's going to control how often dark matter scatters, times the total energy you get when two dark matter particles annihilate. And that's 2m chi. So this is how the power scales. But the number density of dark matter, that's just the mass density, which we know for any given system reasonably well, and as well as the average for the universe, over m chi squared times 2m chi. So this scales like 1 over m chi. It gets better for lower masses. And so in fact, for a lot of indirect detection, like if you're talking about, say, looking for a gamma ray line, it's not just enough to have a lot of power in the gamma ray line. You have to be able to resolve it over background. But there is one class of indirect detection type bit limit that really is just sensitive to the total power. And this is actually, so I don't know if Mariangela talked about this or not. Did she talk about the injection of energy into the CMB from dark matter annihilation? Okay. So I can't do the CMB physics of this justice. I won't try. But the rough picture is this, that if you ask what is the CMB? The CMB is the surface of last scattering corresponding to when we went from a universe full of plasma at early times into a universe that's full of atoms at late times. And so the ionization fraction, the fraction of electrons that are free, as you cool through a certain transition temperature, it falls pretty sharply. And that falling region defines the surface of last scattering. Now, what happens if dark matter is annihilating, injecting lots of power through this whole time? Well, what it'll do, let's say dark matter is annihilating into electrons. They're going to kick some of those atomic electrons out of their atoms, and you end up getting a sort of longer tail on the surface of last scattering. What that longer tail would do, and then this is where somebody else could describe the physics well, but to me it's a bit of I mostly think of it as a black box. What that extra power would do is it would change the shape of the high L modes of the CMB. Okay, so it would change the shape of the smallest scale modes. And you can look for such changes of shape. They're actually a bit degenerate with a tilt of the power spectrum. But you can model this effect. Take Planck data and get a constraint on the maximum power from dark matter annihilation. And that up to a factor of a few. It really is just a few ambiguity of sort of how efficiently that power ionizes electrons. That changes a bit with the dark matter mass, but not by orders of magnitude, only by, you know, between like 0.2 and 0.7 in the efficiency. To a very good approximation, Planck is just sensitive to how much power is coming from dark matter annihilation into the standard model. The mass density of dark matter. So for a given mass, that power constraint can be used to set a limit on the annihilation rate of dark matter right around this surface. That the cross-section times velocity at, so this is not at freeze-out, and this will be important, but at temperatures of order EV, where this last scattering surface is, that cross-section has to be less than, because they haven't seen this signal, less than about 3×10⁻²⁶ centimeters cubed per second times something of order, I'm going to get the order of magnitude wrong, 30 GeV over m chi. So this whole 1 GeV, few GeV dark matter parameter space that I'm talking about, as long as the dark matter is annihilating into standard model particles, would superficially seem to be excluded by this constraint. All right, so I told you direct detection isn't sensitive to it, but now I've just told you indirect detection completely rules it out. There is an important piece, though. So the next question you should ask is, well, how robust is that really? And I kind of emphasized a little bit this point, that it's not constraining the annihilation cross-section at the temperature when dark matter actually froze out. It's constraining the annihilation cross-section at temperatures of order an electron volt. So if, and actually, more than that, if you think about, it's really the annihilation cross-section times roughly, you can think of it as n chi over total dark matter density times n chi bar over total dark matter density. I'll put in a factor of 4. So that conventionally we would assume that this factor is 1. But if those densities are evolving over time, or if that annihilation cross-section is evolving with temperature, either one of these would change the implications of this bound, whether it actually rules out light thermal dark matter or not. So I think there are 3 important caveats. The first important caveat is that, let me give these 2 processes names. I will call this process A and this process B. So I drew processes A and B for fermion dark matter, but if you had charged scalar dark matter, you could write down exact same processes. For scalar dark matter, the cross-section for process A times V scales like V squared thermal average. In other words, it scales like temperature over mass. Why is that? Well, if you look back at the Feynman diagram, you have a spin 1 resonance that you're trying to produce. If you had 2 scalar dark matter particles coming together, then the only way you could ever produce a spin 1 resonance and conserve angular momentum is if those dark matter particle antiparticle pairs carried some angular momentum coming in. So it's a p-wave process, and in the non-relativistic limit, p-wave processes are suppressed by velocity squared. But at freeze-out, T over m is of order 1/30. At the CMB, surface of last scattering, T over m is going to be maybe electron volt over GeV, say, something plausibly in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 9. Even for MeV dark matter, it would be 10 to the minus 6. So actually, if you had sigma V at freeze-out of precisely 3 10 to the minus 26, then for GeV dark matter, you would expect a sigma V at the surface of last scattering of 3 10 to the minus 35. Don't write down the 3. I'm not being that precise. At the level of 10 to the minus 35, which is way below this experiment sensitivity. So that's one important caveat in the case of scalar dark matter. In the case of fermionic dark matter, the annihilation cross-section is actually pretty temperature independent. But I mentioned this possibility that you could have a Dirac fermion split into a light and a heavy mass eigenstate. And in these splittings, and when that happens through some small symmetry breaking effect, the annihilation process that you always have. So the relation of these to chi bar, this is like the real and imaginary part. So chi light would be a chi plus chi bar, and the chi heavy would be a chi I chi minus chi bar type of state. The annihilation process always involves a chi light and a chi heavy. So if chi heavy was depleted, for example, if the mass splitting is larger than an MeV, the chi heavy can actually decay to chi light and then through a dark photon to a little e plus e minus pair. And so if those decays happen before the surface of last scattering, then I've got chi lights around, but no chi heavies, exponentially few chi heavies. And that annihilation process shuts off just because you don't have the right kind of dark matter abundance in the universe to lead to annihilations. So it isn't quite the n chi and chi bar way of thinking about it that I wrote up there, but basically that you need n chi heavy times n chi light going into this process. And n chi heavy times n chi light at temperatures of order an electron volt is much less than n chi heavy times n chi light at freeze out. So this could be another case where you still have no problem with this annihilation cross-section giving rise to the right dark matter abundance, but it wouldn't give you any appreciable signal in the CMB. The third caveat is fairly similar to this one. But goes back to now the picture where I really do have a good symmetry under which chi, global symmetry under which chi is charged. So I can talk about chi number being a global symmetry where chi has charge 1, chi bar has charge minus 1, and just like there's a baryon asymmetry, I could have a chi asymmetry with more chi's than chi bars. And again, in this case, during the sort of the freeze-out process, so in that case, actually most of the abundance of chi that we're left with typically today, like the baryons, would be mostly chi's, not chi bars, set by whatever generated the primordial asymmetry. You would want an annihilation cross-section that is larger than this 3 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. But what that does is it annihilates away chi bar, and once you've annihilated away the chi bar, well, now you're not going to see any signal in the CMB. In terms of processes A and B, you'll notice this is process A. The scenario 2 wouldn't have worked all either for scenario B. Because in that process, even though the coupling is off diagonal, I use it twice. So I would have chi light, intermediate state chi heavy, and then a chi light in the final in the other for the other incoming leg. And that process would always have an n chi light times n chi light rate for this production of the CMB. Okay, so, and this third one, I think, is a very interesting possibility, but of course it's not quite thermal dark matter. These first two possibilities really rely on the mass of the AA prime being larger than the mass of phi or chi, whatever your dark matter is, so that the dominant process in the annihilation was this process A. Is that reasonable? I don't know. It's a binary choice. But that was the one that did a slightly better job anyway of just explaining the numerology of freeze-out. So it's certainly a perfectly reasonable process to consider. So in all of those cases, we can't say anything with indirect detection, we can't say anything with direct detection. So then the question is, what can we actually say about this kind of light dark matter? Is this a testable theory or not? Well, there's actually a lot that we can say. And the reason, in particular, for this scenario A, is that I told you what the cross-section is. And we know numerically what that cross-section should be. So let me just massage this a little bit more. Let me write this formula as epsilon squared times alpha dark. I'll put it over m chi squared here. And I'm going to write this as m chi over m a prime to the fourth. Now, and that we want to be equal to 3 times the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. So we know alpha. I don't know what alpha dark is. But I know that this theory, if it's going to be sort of hiding beyond view, had better be perturbative at least up to sort of LHC energy scales. That implies that alpha dark should be less than about 0.5. And that for this to be the dominant cross-section, for this whole scenario to make sense, this mass ratio had better be less than 1. So that means that I can translate this thermal cross-section value into a lower bound on epsilon for a given dark matter mass. So a lower bound on epsilon and you just saw that from Matt's lecture that a lower bound on epsilon implies a lower bound on dark photon production in laboratory experiments. So you can ask, when is this compatible with those experiments? Now Matt talked mainly about the experiments looking for dark photon decays. So if m chi, I've already now assumed that m chi is less than m a prime. There's a region where m chi is less than m a prime, but I can still consider the case where 2m chi is less than m a prime, or the case where m chi is less than m a prime is less than 2m chi. Right, there's sort of that binary possibility that makes a big difference. This is a bit of a peculiar region, right? I mean, it's just a fact. It's just a factor of two in mass space. But it's important to distinguish them because what the A prime does is very different in these two cases. Here, the A prime can decay to chi chi bar. And there's no epsilon in this coupling, so this is totally going to dominate its decays. In this case, that's kinematically forbidden, and the leading process will be A prime decays to standard model fermions of the kind that Matt discussed. So I want to focus mainly on this case for the rest of this lecture. Not because there's anything wrong with this, just because we haven't talked about it yet. So, focusing on that case, if I can have the projector back again, maybe. Okay, so this is the actual result from Planck on that annihilation. Their constraint on the annihilation cross-section of the function of mass that I already talked about. This is the parameter space.
What was the x, the y-axis
on this? Oh, on the Planck one?
Yeah.
Good. So this is the annihilation cross-section, sigma v, at surface of last scattering. This f effective was this efficiency factor that I briefly mentioned, for how much of the power from annihilation actually goes into ionizing electrons. For example, if you were annihilating entirely into neutrinos, that wouldn't be very efficient. And I think I mentioned that that's typically of order 1, like 0.1 to between 0.2 and 0.7 for most scenarios. So the reason that they say thermal relic isn't a line but a broad band on here is precisely because of the uncertainty in what that effective is. But on the whole, it's like a factor of 3 on this scale.
Where would the lower bound come on that line? I'm sure you could dial the effective down as far as you wanted.
Yeah, so there are situations, for the extreme case is that you're annihilating into something that has no standard, something else that's beyond the standard model. And then this constraint would really need to be either ignored or applied with great diligence. So the lower bound, I mean, what this actually comes from is people did simulations for lots of dark matter masses, lots of different standard model decay modes, sorry, annihilation modes, what happens if you annihilate to Ws, to Bs, to charm, to leptons, and sort of found the reasonable range of what was encompassed by those, which that range spans about this factor of 3. But absolutely, you can construct models where the annihilation products are non-standard model, and the F effective would be way down here. So that's yet another sense in which this bound is not robust.
But then wouldn't we have a Higgins sector that's now very heavy? Would just be like extra dark matter? Like
so you know, if we want to talk about crazy models, so I can have, you know, chi annihilate through some force into a new object. I don't know what I want to call it. I'm not very creative today. I'll just call these psi. Psi psi bar. Psi is lighter than chi. And that gives you the abundance of chi. Now, once that freezes out, you ask, well, what happens to the abundance for chi? For psi, sorry. It's entirely possible that those psis have a stronger interaction that keeps them in. Well, it's entirely possible that those psis, for example, are charged under another new force that mixes very weakly with the standard model, but has a mediator that's lighter than the psi. So this is the A prime, and this is the A double prime. And you know, the picture here is that, so I have my U1 prime, my U1 double prime, and I'm going to imagine that chi and psi are both charged under the U1 prime, but only psi is charged under the double prime. The prime gauge boson is heavier than chi. The double prime gauge boson is lighter than psi. So in other words, Ma prime is larger than M chi, is larger than M psi, is larger than Ma double prime. For example, the A double primes then just decay back to standard model matter. And I believe this is a way to sort of sequester dark matter annihilation to have the, well, I don't necessarily have any mixing between this, any appreciable mixing at all between this A prime and the standard model. So I don't necessarily have any direct detection. And all these indirect detections have to be filtered through producing psis and then letting the psis annihilate into A double primes. So, you know, this is a very hidden possibility for dark matter. You know, yeah, so okay, I guess this falls into the category of things that are too crazy for me to talk about. But it's an existence proof, right? And it's probably not worth talking about beyond the level of an existence, beyond that fact. So let's see, did I lose my screen? Yeah. So okay. Sorry, more on that actually. Is there another question? All right, so I'll go back to my simple model where I'm just annihilating directly to the standard model. And by the way, it's often useful to construct your little existence proof models and think through them, see whether they really work, even if you don't particularly think that model is right, because you might learn something interesting from it. So this is just a plot that has far too many lines on it, but it sort of illustrates what I was saying, that given particular, you know, given these mass ratios, for a given M chi, there's a lower bound on the dark photon production. Of course, once I'm assuming given a bound on a particular minimum ratio between chi and A prime masses, I can also translate that into a minimum production cross section for a given mediator mass. And so that lets me parametrize. Well, there's constraints on epsilon that are just invariant, independent of how the dark photon decays, et cetera. There are constraints from production of a dark photon that decays invisibly. And I'll talk about all of those in a second. I can sort of compare all of those to the minimum epsilon that's allowed, that's compatible with thermal freeze-out. And you see that while these have not excluded the minimum possible epsilon consistent with freeze-out, they're making, so all these gray regions are actual experimental constraints that are making some interesting headway in the sub-GeV region. Now, there's another way of thinking about that parameter space. My computer just fell asleep. There's another way of thinking about the parameter space that I think is initially much less intuitive, but eventually much clearer. And there's not much point to me talking about this other parametrization unless I can get the plot up. Okay. Which is to just take this whole combination here. Okay. So this involves a lot of parameters in my theory, product of a lot of parameters, ratio of masses. And just look at the constraints as how do they think about any given search. Let's say you have a search that's a constraint on epsilon. Think about how you can combine the constraint on epsilon, this perturbativity bound on alpha dark, the mass ratio bound for the scenario of interest, how you could combine those into an effective limit on this combination. And if that effective limit were to ever cross the combination you need in order to get the right relic abundance, then you would say, actually, that dark matter model is robustly ruled out. You have to combine several things to do it. You have to combine an accelerator search that gives you a constraint on epsilon, a perturbativity argument that gives you a constraint on alpha dark, this sort of hierarchy assumption that was necessary just for the scenario to make sense. But you would get a robust constraint on that combination. This is a useful way to go. I think, first of all, just because my co-authors and I started writing simpler plots, slightly simpler plots by the time we switched to this variable, and so I can actually explain all the lines. But also because your relic abundance is really just an invariant target that you're trying to hit with all these different experiments. Then you ask, well, how well do they do it? So let me go through sort of top to bottom and try to explain what each of these constraints is coming from. So that LHC bound, what that's coming from is searches for a single jet produced in association with missing transverse energy. So this is the canonical direct search for dark matter at the LHC. And the idea of this search is that if you count events as a function of how much missing transverse energy they have, well, most of the events, you know, selecting events with at least one hard jet, there's a lot of QCD events. Most of those QCD events will have very low missing energy. It's just the result of a mismeasurement of the jet. Then there's a sort of characteristic scale of missing energy that you tend to get from the Z. So this is the piece from, I'll draw that solid, a Z plus jet, where the Z goes to nu bar. So that's a real source of missing energy. And of course, there's PDFs going out to really high center of mass energies where the Z gets a big transverse momentum. And so therefore, you would get a large missing transverse momentum from those two neutrinos. So this does have a tail. But what you can look for is processes with an even bigger tail. Okay, and if you're searching for dark matter that's interacting through very heavy particles or for very heavy dark matter with substantial interactions, that could be a good way to go. So this is where you'd look for signal. But it's clearly not very, I mentioned this, by the way. Actually, the only reason that we even include it is that it's often said that these constraints are very good for light dark matter and are superior to direct detection for light dark matter. And that's true if the light dark matter is interacting through some very heavy mediator. But it's not so true if the dark matter is interacting through a light weakly coupled mediator, right? Because if it's a light weakly coupled mediator, what's that saying? It's saying that the characteristic energy scale that you're going to get relative to, say, Z plus jet coming from that new mediator is going to be closer to the bottom, going to be a lower missing energy scale, and that the overall normalization of that signal is also going to be relatively low because it's a weakly coupled mediator. So what you'd actually have is a sort of small signal down here. And it also has a tail, like the Z, because of the PDF. But the tail has the same shape as the Z tail, and typically a lower normalization. And so that's why this is only, that actually illustrates one of the drawbacks of this axis. Is it because I've put so many factors together, it looks like that's constraining something at the 10 to the minus 4 level. And that's true, but the 10 to the minus 4 is mostly coming from this alpha dark, from saying that this ratio, and I'm actually requiring this ratio to be less than 3 rather than less than 1 in the plot, just to get away from the resonance region where this denominator would be very small. And then a constraint on epsilon squared that's like a third or something like that. So that's a very weak constraint. Now, next line down is from LEP. And that's mainly a precision electroweak constraint that basically a sufficiently large mixing A prime, so this is a constraint something like epsilon has to be less than 0.03 over a wide range of mediator masses. And that's just coming from the effect of A prime mixing on the ratio of the Z mass to the W mass. Okay, so that sets some constraint on epsilon. Now, more powerful than that, so there's a substantially more powerful search at Babar. This is a search for basically a photon produced in association with an A prime. So the cross section is going to go like epsilon squared over the center of mass energy squared of the collider. Now, the A prime here is invisible, so I'm not going to be able to reconstruct a resonance like you would in a mu plus mu minus final state. But this is an E plus E minus collider. We know the four momenta of the initial electron and positron. If you measure the four momentum of the outgoing photon, then you can infer the whole four momentum just by conservation. You can infer the four momentum of the A prime, of the invisible stuff. And once you've inferred its four momentum, you can ask what's its invariant mass. And so this is called a missing mass. Missing mass search, and there's some background. It actually looks like that. And you would look for little bumps on that missing mass that you infer from reconstructing the photon's kinematics. So that sets some pretty good limits on epsilon, which you could see more clearly on the previous slide. Sorry about this shutting off every 2 or 3 minutes. So in each of these cases, every one of these is a constraint on epsilon, which I'm just combining with the conservative limits on alpha dark and on this mass ratio in order to get a sense of whether they're hitting this relic density target. Now, you see, for example, so I have a left and a right-hand plot. The left plot was for a pseudo-Dirac dark matter. The right plot was for a scalar dark matter. So pseudo-Dirac was this caveat number 2, scalar was caveat number 1 up there. You see that this Babar line has hit the relic density right up around a GeV mass for the scalar model, where you need slightly larger couplings to get a good relic density. The couplings that you want to be sensitive to for the fermion model are a little bit lower, so it looks like it hasn't quite hit that relic density curve. That does not mean that the Babar search is irrelevant or insensitive to dark matter, because to get that range, I didn't plug in the real world value of alpha dark. I don't know what that is. I plugged in the maximum possible value of alpha dark. I didn't plug in the real world value of this mass ratio. I plugged in the bound on that mass ratio. So it's certainly possible that something that you discover that could have been discovered in this search that had found something would be a viable dark matter model. You just wouldn't have enough parameter measurements to know. Now, okay, this xenon 10 line, very briefly, that is, so that's a direct, xenon 10 is a direct detection experiment. But this is not the standard xenon 10 analysis. In fact, that curve is not even an analysis by the xenon 10 collaboration. It was analysis by a group of independent authors, some of them former xenon collaborators, trying to understand what constraints you could infer from the xenon data on dark matter electron scattering. So that xenon curve was a limit on chi electron scattering. And that chi electron scattering really does have a cross section the scales is the same combination of epsilon squared alpha dark over mediator mass to the fourth. Same combination as the relic density. So unlike everything else on this plot, that's really an apples to apples comparison, right? You ask, has xenon 10 probed viable models of dark matter in this category? No, not unless that brown line overlaps the black one. Whereas for Babar, the reason there's this purple line here is to indicate it's probing models up here. It's also sensitive to some models down here, but not to all models down there. It depends on other parameters of the theory. Does that make sense? The distinction I'm drawing there? Okay. So down here on the lower side, you'll see these some other experiments mentioned. So LSND and E137. These are both beam dump experiments. That were done quite a while ago. The experiments are actually extremely different from one another. So LSND was a neutrino experiment. Took 800 MeV, I think it's 800, it's of that scale, protons on a target. And then they had a big, so here's your protons coming in, big target, and a big bath, a big neutrino detector. Not big by modern standards. But time, big neutrino detector downstream. Also found some anomalies in neutrino physics, but I won't talk about that. E137 was a 1980s experiment at SLAC using a 30 JeV electron beam hitting some target. And then there's a big hill. It's about 200 meters worth of hill. Then there's a dip. And then there's a detector. This is not to scale, sorry. Then there's a detector about 100 meters away. Where they basically had some scintillator paddles looking for anything that might have come from that electron beam. Okay, so they both have a sort of similar structure, that there's a beam hitting a target. The target should stop most things in it, except for very weakly interacting particles, and then you have a detector downstream. But the scales, the energy scales, the length scales, the particles being used are completely different. In this case, but the essential structure is the same. Let me just explain it for E137 first, because I think it's slightly simpler. You have processes where an electron's coming in, and basically, electrons in a target, they stop dominantly by interacting with the nucleus, having hard Bremsstrahlung processes. That's their dominant interaction. But every now and then, instead of a hard Bremsstrahlung, you can produce a dark photon that decays to chi-chi bar. So ordinary products of the electromagnetic shower would stop in the shield, or if they don't stop in the shield, they'd certainly stop in the hill. But these dark matter particles, they're pretty weakly interacting. They can penetrate onwards. And then a dark matter particle could actually scatter off an electron in the detector. And those dark matter particles could actually have pretty high energy and could transfer significant energy to the electron. And in that case, that kicked electron would be visible downstream. So I think they only saw something like 3 events total in this experiment. And it was like, I don't know, the number I'm remembering is like 30 coulombs. But I think one of these numbers is 20 and the other one's 30. Not sure which. Sort of an irrelevant detail. They saw 3 events. So you get pretty good constraints, turns out, on dark matter interaction from this process. Even though this one, this cross-section scales like epsilon squared, and this cross-section scales like epsilon squared alpha dark, I can again combine those with my conservative limits on alpha dark to get some comparison to the dark matter abundance. Over here, it's a similar story for the proton beams, except that instead of producing the dark matter or the dark photons directly from the protons, the dominant process is that proton-nuclear interactions produce pi naughts. Pi naughts usually decay to gamma-gamma, but there's an epsilon-squared branching fraction to go to gamma-A prime, and that would be the source of the dark matter. And then you would actually look for scattering off protons in the detector rather than scattering off electrons. Similar ideas in both cases. Now, let's see. I'm happy to tell you guys offline about this red line, which is a sort of new idea that we have. But I want to stop here and take any questions that you guys might have instead of going into that now.
Maybe it's also worth emphasizing how complementary this whole thing is to normal direct detection, and that you can see already in the units used. But normal direct detection is in the same plot, but in GeV. Every single of the x-axis is in GeV, and here it's in MeV. So it's
yeah.
Like a whole different territory.
Indeed. So actually, now that I have my screen back, I can go back to the direct detection plot that I was searching for, and you really see how, even in thinking about this, you know, people usually don't go below the 1 GeV, much below the 1 GeV scale. Super CDMS at SNOLAB might be able to get down to a couple of hundred MeV. But they're running into thresholds big time if you try to go any lower. Yeah.
Where does xenon 10 have some pretty good stuff, but not any other ones?
Xenon 10 is the only, so the first thing to say is that the sensitivity, the scale, so that is not the standard xenon 10 experiment. The standard xenon 10 analysis. It was a search for dark matter electron scattering. There are other experiments working on similar searches. It's really background dominated. If you think about what the direct detection experiments spent their time on historically, they've tried to get their background down in two ways. One is by going really deep underground. The other is by getting all the pesky electron backgrounds and finding better and better ways to discriminate electron recoils from nuclear recoils. And so they work really hard to get the nuclear recoil level down to one or two events by rejecting thousands of electron recoil events. So then the challenge, so then if you ask, well, can they all go out and set limits on dark matter electron scattering. They're just, in many cases, not really any better than the xenon 10 limits because it's all limited by, you know, they have background and they don't have a way to subtract it reliably. And there are quite a few ideas for out there that people have been thinking about for how to take that xenon 10 type sensitivity. If you were to convert this to asking, like, with equal electron and proton couplings, how sensitive would this be? Like, what would the analogous dark matter proton coupling be, that the dark matter proton cross-section be, based on the coupling sensitivity of this experiment? It would be something really pathetically off the chart of this, because there is so much background. I think the dark matter electron scattering cross-section limits are at the level of something like 10 to the minus 37 or 38. But remember that has an electron mass in the numerator, squared in the numerator, not a proton mass squared in the numerator. So it's really less sensitive, even sort of weaker couplings compared to this stuff. Actually, that's already kind of illustrated by this plot here, where I've got, you know, in coupling sensitivity, six orders of magnitude difference between super CDMS and xenon 10 in terms of couplings, right? But then if you go back here and ask, how's super CDMS going to do at low masses on this scale, order hundreds of MeV, compared to what xenon 100 has done and Lux has done and Xenon, you know, Xenon 110 and LZ will do at high masses, and that is in turn pathetic by four orders of magnitude. So it's really a tough game, this electron scattering. What people have tried to do, and what I think is interesting in this region, is to try to see, well, how can you at least, even if you can't go down much further because of backgrounds, can you at least go outwards, lower the thresholds of electron scattering sensitivity, for example, to be as sensitive down here. Now, for this particular model, that doesn't seem like an extremely motivated thing to do because that's all constrained by LSND. But there are cases, for sure, where xenon 10 could have comparable sensitivity, could have new sensitivity. Or rather, sorry, not xenon 10, where electron scattering experiments could have interesting sensitivity at lower masses if you could bring the thresholds down. But yeah, I know people on xenon 100 and Lux that I've asked them, you know, are you doing this analysis? And they sort of say, yeah, we're thinking about it, but it's so background dominated that we're not spending that much time on it.
Direct detection experimentalists are afraid of background. Like, they do not want to even think about it. If they have one background term, it keeps them out for nights. They finally got CDMS to do a lot of analysis.
Do what? A likelihood analysis? Really?
Yeah. Wow.
With this bashing of direct detection experiments, we will
sorry.
We do have to take a break now. But Natalia is around, and we still have another lecture tomorrow. So if you have any more questions, you can ask her. But let's thank her and then take a break.